From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the man who discovered Marlon Brando and James Dean and directed them in now classic movies. Director Ilya Kazan has written an autobiography. Also today, we speak with a modern master of an ancient art, cartographer Stuart Allen. His maps are based on the latest computer technology and a respect for the traditions of his craft. Pianist Harry Connick Jr. shows off his hometown of New Orleans in our weekly performance piece. And critic at large Laurie Stone talks about a group using art to dispel myths about AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When would-be actors and neighborhood hams do their imitations of Brando, they're doing scenes from movies directed by my guest Ilya Kazan. Kazan directed Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. He also directed the films East of Eden, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, A Face in the Crowd, and The Last Tycoon. Kazan has had an equally important career in the theater. In the 1930s, he worked with the Group Theater, where he followed the vision of Lee Strasberg and learned the style of acting that became known as the Method. He later co-founded the Actors Studio with Strasberg. Many of Kazan's friends and colleagues never forgave him for naming names when he was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during its relentless search for communists. For many years, Kazan refused to publicly address the subject, but he breaks the silence in his new autobiography, Ilya Kazan, A Life. Before we meet Kazan, here's your opportunity to play Dueling Brandos.
Hey, shut up!
You put that howling down there and go to bed.
Yes, I want my girls out here.
You shut up! You're going to get the law, are you?
Hey, shut up! You're going
to see that woman and then call her back, because she ain't going to come. You're going to have a baby.
Listen, you're
I hope they haul you in and turn a fire
hose
on you.
Girls, I want my girls out.
You stinker!
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
I wouldn't mix in this.
Ilya Kazan, welcome to Fresh Air. John Ford advised you when you switched from theater to movies to direct films as if they were silent films, to really use pictures to tell the story. Yet, you have directed some of the most memorable scenes of dialogue in film history, and I find that a kind of interesting irony.
That's true. It's just my background, Terry. I mean, I do come from the theater, and I have always directed dialogue scenes, and Jack came out of movies. He directed two reelers and westerns and so on, and it was natural for him to say what he did, but it was a lesson to me, and I try to make a film that would be clear and stand on its own despite not having the dialogue, without the dialogue, put it that way. And I used to watch Jack shoot and talk to him sometimes on weekends, and I got a lot out of him, how swift you can be, and that the audience doesn't need to know quite as much as it had to know in the theater.
I want to talk with you specifically about some of the movies you've directed and some of the scenes within those films. Let's start with A Streetcar Named Desire. Now, you actually really discovered Marlon Brando for the stage version of that, which you directed before directing the film. Why did you want him to audition for the role in the stage version?
Well, there was no audition. I had produced a play with Harold Klerman where he played a part, and he played like a 5-6 minute scene, and he was stupendous in it. He was marvelous in it, and that was his audition. He didn't know it. But then when we lost John Garfield and I began to think who really would be good as Stanley Kowalski, I thought of Marlon and gave him $20 to go up and see Tennessee Williams up at the Cape. I learned later he hadn't showed up, but he'd hitchhiked and used the $20 to eat with. So, but anyway, Williams took to him immediately. He called me up. He was ecstatic. He was overwhelmed, and that's all the audition there was.
When I think of all the actors and all the people in general who have imitated Brando doing Stella, untold numbers of people, what went on when you were directing him in that scene?
In that scene?
Yeah.
I just told him to get on his knees at the bottom of the staircase, but I didn't tell him what to do with his voice or how he should shout it. He just knew. Many, many things with him, many, many times with him, he was ahead of me. That is, he understood what I said and understood it better than I said it. and I hardly had to tell him anything. Once I said, you fall on your knees, and he did, and that's all there was to it.
How many takes did you do of that scene?
How many takes did I do? I think two.
And you knew you had it?
Yeah. Well, you couldn't mistake it, could you, really? That tone of voice, I mean, people have imitated it and shouted it spin on comedy shows and everything. It's just once in a decade a voice like that comes out.
Now, you directed Brando again 3 years later in On the Waterfront. I found out in your book that it was initially supposed to be Frank Sinatra in the role.
Yeah, he would have been damn good, too, but not as good as Brando. I don't think anybody's as good as Brando, but Frank would have been very good. Frank comes from Hoboken, and he's a street kid, too, and he's tough, and he would have been good, and he's tough the way Brando's tough. He's got a tough exterior and knows what to do with his fists and so on, but he also has a very poetic and romantic side that comes out in his songs, of course. Anyway, I was ready to do it with Frank, but one thing led to another in the contracting, and also in Frank's schedule. He had to be somewhere at a certain time. I've forgotten the details of it, and we switched to Brando.
Brando in that movie really has this combination of strength and vulnerability.
Right, Terry, you hit it.
What did you talk with him about when he took on the role? About what characteristics you wanted him to get in there?
Just that. I said he keeps a tough front towards everybody, but he feels his guilt about Eva Marie Saint's brother terribly, that it kills him. He can't get rid of it. And he really would like to be out of the gangster hoodlum world and didn't like what they did to him because they humiliate him. The part Lee Cobb played constantly humiliated him, made him appear like a cheap kid, and I told him that he would resent that and not show it for a while, and then release it as the film went on.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it before you do.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
That skunk we got you for the manager, he brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie, it was you. You remember that night in the garden, you came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly. When he says taking dives, Palookaville, all that, and it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. Once a fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Gosh. Ilya Kazan is my guest, director of film and theater. He's also a novelist and has written a new autobiography, which is titled Ilya Kazan, A Life. Let's move on to another movie you directed. Now, we talked about how you really basically discovered Marlon Brando. You also really discovered James Dean. You gave him his first film role in your film East of Eden.
Yeah.
I find that kind of interesting in a way because they were both at the time young actors with this pent-up energy and alienation?
Yeah, that's it. Alienation is right. Pent-up energy is right. Terry, you've got it exactly right. Not especially. Both of them, the same way. Same thing in both of them. Somehow that must have appealed to me because maybe I have pent-up energy and alienation, too. I feel brotherly towards them.
Would you describe the meeting with James Dean that made you realize he had something?
I went to see a play of his, and a friend of mine named Paul Osborne had recommended him to me. And I went to see him in a play. He played a part of an Arab, a small part. And I didn't think much of him, but I thought just to please Paul, I'd ask him to come into Warner Brothers office. And I went in there that day, and there he was, like a pile of rags in a corner, all bent over, scrunched up, and so on. I thought, well, he didn't even get up, didn't even look at me, he didn't get up. And so I went in the office and I thought, well, I'll make the son of a bitch wait. A little bit will do him good. So anyway, finally I called him into the office and he came in and he didn't say anything. He was not a talker. So finally he didn't say a damn thing. And I said, well, and he said, you want to go for a ride with me on my motorbike? So I said, God, I hate motorbikes. I didn't say it to him, but I do hate motorbikes. I think they're a menace. And I said, all right, Jimmy, well, let's go. So I went downstairs, and he got his motorbike and unlatched it or unchained it or whatever he did. And I got in the back, and he rode me around the middle of the city. And it was like he was showing that a country boy can defy the city and defy the rules of the city. He zigzagged in and out. I didn't want to ruin my relationship as a director by saying, Jimmy, I'm frightened, cut it out. I was frightened. But anyway, we finally both lived.
I want to play a scene from this movie. And this is a scene where, well, let me, for our listeners who haven't seen the movie in a long time, in East of Eden, there's a father played by Raymond Massey, and he has two sons. One son he favors. The son he doesn't favor is James Dean. And James Dean has worked really, really, really hard to endear himself to his father. He's invested money in bean futures in the hopes of making back money that his father lost. And it's his father's birthday. He's presenting him the money, but his father won't accept it. Here's that scene with Raymond Massey and James Dean.
That's for you. And it's all the money you lost in the lettuce business. That's for you, and I made it for you.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad. I want you to have it.
You'll have to give it back.
Who? I can't give it.
To the people you got it from.
No, British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody, Dad. We paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over market for that stuff.
Cal, I signed my name. And boys go out, and some die. and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that? I don't want the money, Cal. I couldn't take it. I thank you for the thought, but...
I'll keep it for you. I'll wrap it up, and we'll just keep it in here.
I'll never take it.
There's a great part right after that where you can't tell whether James Dean is going to hug or slug his father.
That is good, yeah.
Now, you write in your book that there really was a tension between James Dean and Raymond Massey. And
yes,
you basically tried to exploit that in the movie.
They didn't like each other. And especially Ray Massey couldn't stand Dean. He just hated to play scenes with him. And I guess I did exploit it because I didn't do anything about curing it or easing it. And you see how much he resents him in the scene, in the role, but also he did in life. And it served my purposes to not do anything about it. I didn't egg them on to each other, but I didn't do anything to keel it.
If James Dean had more technique as an actor, if he had been more experienced, would it have been unnecessary to play up that antagonism in real life between Dean and Massey?
It wouldn't have hurt, Terry. The truth is it wouldn't have hurt. Everybody's so chummy on a stage set, you know. Everybody gets coffee and gets flattered and everything else, and very soon they lose the sense of what they... a very driving emotion underneath the scene. They become comfortable. Comfortable is not good when an actor gets too and stays away from everybody and stays, just is flattered and has his girlfriend there too. God knows what goes on. You know, it's better to irritate them a little bit so they're on edge. I mean, it's very serious business, a emotional film.
Yeah. My guest is Ilya Kazan. He's one of the leading theater and film directors of our time. His movies include On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, Splendor in the Grass, Baby Doll, and A Face in the Crowd. He's written a new autobiography titled A Life. We'll talk more about his work after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Kazan is my guest. You know, in the clips that we just heard, we heard from Brando and from Dean, two very different actors in that Brando you describe as an actor with a lot of technique, Dean as an actor who had virtually none, at least at the time you directed him. How does that change you as a director, depending on whether you're working with someone who has a lot of technique or someone who's more of a natural and doesn't have that technique?
You adapt to what each one is. I talked more to Jimmy than I ever did to Marlon. I took him aside and finally, when I felt he was disturbed in life by what was happening in his own personal life, I moved him into a dressing room on the Warner Brother lot, and I took the dressing room directly facing it so that I'd always be at hand. I was like a father to him or a big brother to him, and I looked after him. Every morning I'd call him out and see what condition he was in, whether he had a miserable night or not. And then I had to several times stop him from owning a horse or a motorbike or whatever, you know. So it became a very different, more intense, more particular relationship. With Marlon, I didn't have to do anything like that.
Let's talk more about acting and your style of directing. Now, you were a member of the group Theater in the mid-30s and a co-founder of the Actor Studio. These are the two places where what's been called the Method was born. How would you describe the Method, and do you think of yourself as subscribing to it?
The method has to do with retreat from artificial emotionalism, where emotion is conveyed by signs and gestures and voice patterns and so forth, but where it's where on the other hand it's actually felt by the actor. He actually feels it, the emotion that he's portraying. It's there in him. And there are techniques which are obvious. They're not so complicated and not so mysterious for arousing emotion by remembering certain things in yourself so that the scene becomes, in a sense, a part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of yourself as directing with the method, with that method?
I think I do, yes. I think I try to get the real thing out of actors, and I try to stop them from in what we call indicating or gesturing, suggesting a scene by the way they are. In England, they do it. They do it differently. The voice is very important there, and the way they have different kinds of plays there. And I don't think that I'm any good to direct Shakespeare or George Bernard Shaw or any play that depends on the way lines are read. I think I'm only good when the somehow or other the play relates to my own experience.
And to the experience of the actor who's playing it.
That's correct. Right, Terry.
Let me quote something you say about Strasberg's style. You say that in life people conceal their feelings, but with Strasberg's pupils, they brandished their emotions as if that were the only true measure of talent.
He encouraged that so that the whoever would feel, Strasberg, their teacher would feel, and I would feel as the person directing many of them, that they had great intensity and that they were noteworthy for their violence, so that you felt, God, I've got to see that. But the plays that we did at that time were also plays of that type. You've just seen two scenes from it, you know?
Yeah.
There were plays where intense emotion rather than coolness and charm and wit and the rest of it were important. I wish the people in the studio had more wit and charm, but you can't have everything in life, and they contributed markedly and importantly to the kind of play that we did.
Is there a danger in that kind of acting where you're really experiencing the emotions of going over the top?
Yes, there is, Terry. That's right.
So how do you draw the line on that? How do you measure?
The director draws the line, Terry. Mm-hmm. The director says, I've got it. That's enough. Don't go on with it.
So how do you bring someone back down if they're going over the top?
Just look at them.
Tell them less.
They understand right away. They understand. You just say, or you stop the scene and you go back and you do things that are will anchor them. In other words, by suggesting certain realistic things. For example, if people start yelling, you say the house next door can hear you. Try to do it so the house next door doesn't hear you. Do you understand?
Yeah. Let me quote something and get your reaction to what you've said. When I hear the term masterclass, I want to vomit.
Well, that's because so much of teaching has become a racket. In other words, so much money is made teaching 40, 50 people how to act. And that's all right. That can be valuable. There are some wonderful teachers. Sanford Meisner was one of them. Bobby Lewis, a fine teacher. And Stella Adler was the fine teacher. But then there's a whole lot of other people that teach hundreds of people. And it's just one thing that happens is it's a distinction to be in their class or in their, what they call, in their group. And that's when you hear master class. And,
right.
Nobody's a master. Acting is, like all art, a variant. It's a mysterious thing. Sometimes this method is good for the play you're working on. Sometimes it's not. You always have to allow for human variance and ambivalences.
Ilya Kazan is my guest, and he's written an autobiography titled A Life. Now, your autobiography is really the first time you've publicly addressed why you named names during the HUAC hearings
in
the 1950s. And I was wondering why you were ready to talk about it now. For years when you were interviewed, people would ask you about it and you just wouldn't want to talk about it. People have written in their autobiographies how they felt about you naming names, but you've never publicly addressed it till now.
The reason I felt okay about it now was that I always hesitated to do it because I wanted to make it part of my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so that everything that happened before had some way or other, not for others, but for me, led up to it. And, for example, I put in the scene where the man from Detroit came and attacked me in front of my group. I put in the scene where we were trying to do a picture in Mexico and the communists there prevented us from doing it for their reasons. I put in other references so that by the time I got to it, you felt I'd been through certain experiences that would at least motivate me, if no one else, into doing that.
Well, my understanding is that you decided to talk for two reasons. One was that you felt that when you were a member of a communist group that the actors are really exploited by the party, and also that you didn't want to give up your career, that you'd really thought about it, and you decided that writers could write while they're in prison, but directors couldn't do anything in prison, and directors couldn't do anything if they were shut out of the industry.
Something like that, but not exactly. I thought, I love my work, and it means everything to me. It's my whole life, really, except my family, and my work. Those are the two things I have. And I thought, why should I give up my career for something I don't believe in? I don't believe in it. And if people who are communists are still going to attack me and still feel that they don't want to talk about it. I also feel that, then the hell with them. I also feel that any country, for example, England and France, any country has the right to investigate something like was going on in this country. And the only trouble with our committee was that two of the fellows lied to me. They told me that I was in an executive session where I'd be talking privately, and it turned out they were running with the news to Hollywood gossip columnists and everything else, so I lost my respect for them, too.
There are many people who have been in your life who have never forgiven you for naming names and have certainly never forgotten it. Did you expect this decision to stay with you throughout your life in the way that it has?
No, you have to believe me, Terry. I don't give a darn about that.
Uh-huh.
I only am concerned, really, whether I respect myself. I thought a very long time about it. I thought very hard about it, and I did I made a difficult choice. Both sides, both ways would have been difficult for me.
Have you had second thoughts about the choice you made?
Not really, no. I think I wish they'd done it. I wish they'd named me. I think if the whole bunch of us had come out and said, we did have a communist cell, so what? I don't think they would have been worse off. I think it would have been clear the air. But, of course, except for the three I did talk to, they didn't do it.
Ilya Kazan is my guest. I want to get to something you say at the very, very end of your book. You say that when you die, you don't want a big memorial shindig with lots of speeches. You want a big party, but no speeches, and you want everyone that you've ever known invited, including even your enemies, if they're still alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Why do you want that?
Well, because I really am an old-fashioned family-type Mediterranean man. I do like my family enormously. I have a great big family. I have five grandchildren, one more on the way. I have five children. I have stepchildren. I have all kinds of friends that I've had through the years. Not alienated, the opposite. They've become closer and closer. And I just want to say to them, thank you very much for what you've given me in the way of experience and happiness. And here, have a party. And there are all my sweaters and books and things. Help yourself.
You've left money in your will for this party.
Yep.
Why do you want all your enemies to come?
Why not? Then I don't feel about them. I mean, things heal, don't they, after a while? I think so. Anyway, I don't have any bad feeling about anybody. I'm very happy at the moment. I'm very proud of this book. It's called A Life. I'm very proud of it. I think it's a marvelous book, and I think in time, when anybody wants to look back in the 50s and 60s and 70s in American public culture, they will have to read this book, and I think it's a landmark kind of book, so I'm proud I did it. I also did it before I got too old to remember anything, so I'm glad I did that, too.
Okay. I bet you wish you could be around to watch this party when it happens.
I would, yes. I would. I hope there's good liquor there, that's all. I hope nobody gets a hangover.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You've been very nice.
Ilya Kazan has written an autobiography titled A Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll talk with Michael Nesmith, the only original member of the Monkees who didn't perform in the reunion concerts. He's been busy doing other things, creating the prototype for MTV, producing music videos, and producing films such as Repo Man and Tapeheads. I hope you can join us.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. People say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
We go where we want to, do what we like to do. We don't have time to get restless, there's always something new.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, and people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing. Put anybody down. We're just trying to be friendly. Come and watch us sing and play. We're the young generation.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Stuart Allen sees the world in black and white, in red and blue, and just about every other color. Allen's a cartographer whose work is both accurate and dazzling. Coming up, I talk with mapmaker Stuart Allen. Also in our weekly performance segment, New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. plays songs from his hometown. And critic at large Laurie Stone talks about a group of artists working to disseminate information about AIDS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. French President François Mitterrand has ended the first day of a visit to Moscow by holding a joint television interview with Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. Interviewed by French journalists, the Soviet leader said he would soon be meeting with officials from the republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. Roger Morier reports from Paris.
This visit was supposed to show how French-Soviet relations are improving. But the events in the southern Soviet Union are overshadowing the Mitterrand trip. In the joint television interview this evening, Gorbachev said he would soon be meeting delegations from each of the two southern republics where ethnic tensions have led to violence this week. Gorbachev said that cooperation was the only way to find a solution acceptable to both ethnic groups. And he claimed that his policy of glasnost allowed people from the regions a chance to air their grievances in public for the first time. On other topics, Gorbachev said the Soviet Union plans to stick to its word in removing all of its troops from Afghanistan by the middle of next February. And he welcomed positive signals coming out of Washington from the current and future administrations on the pursuit of arms control talks. Gorbachev also took the opportunity to underline his idea of what he calls a common European house. He shared, he says, Mitterrand's idea that greater contact and cooperation among Europeans will be one of the great themes in foreign affairs in the last part of this century and the beginning of the next. For National Public Radio, this is Roger Morier in Paris.
Officials say an earthquake shook portions of New England and the New York metropolitan area today, shaking skyscrapers in lower Manhattan and giving jitters to apartment dwellers throughout the region. The National Weather Service says the earthquake shook the region just about a half an hour ago and was reported as far north as Montreal. They also reported minor damage in Vermont. Israeli jets have once again attacked militia positions in Lebanon in two separate raids today. Israeli warplanes pounded areas that are held by the Sunni Muslim Popular Liberation Army, killing at least five people and injuring more than a dozen others. Security sources say that at least three of the wounded were children. The attack was the first by Israeli jets this year on PLA positions. The Palestine Liberation Organization applied for a U.S. visa today for its chairman, Yasser Arafat. The PLO has announced that Arafat will travel to New York to address the United Nations on December 1st when it opens its debate on the Palestine question. In South Africa, a new right-wing majority in one town council has voted to ban blacks from using many public facilities, reestablishing apartheid practices that had previously been eliminated. We have more from NPR's John Madison in Johannesburg.
About 20 miles east of Johannesburg, the town council of Boksburg, which is now controlled by the far-right Conservative Party, has voted to impose strict segregation. Whites-only signs will go up at the lake, and blacks will also be barred from using the town hall, the libraries, and the swimming pool. There has been an outcry from local business leaders who fear that blacks will boycott the town's shops. They also warn that new whites-only signs could revive international anti-apartheid groups who will call for new economic sanctions. Next week, the Associated Chambers of Commerce meet with the Conservative Party leader Andries Treurnicht to warn him of the consequences of his policies for business. Meanwhile, the government must decide whether to use its powers to stop Conservative town councils segregating towns that the government recently began to desegregate. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
White House budget adviser Joseph Wright said today that President Reagan will be giving Congress a blueprint for eliminating the federal budget deficit by 1993. Wright said the plan would include no new taxes. Wright told reporters that cuts in the 1989 deficit would focus on federal credit programs, controls on federal spending for entitlement programs such as Medicare, and other programs disliked by Reagan. Mr. Reagan will send his final budget to Congress on January 9th. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last year, pianist Harry Connick Jr. arrived on the national jazz scene after releasing his debut recording on Columbia Records. He was 19 years old and fresh from New Orleans, where he grew up with the music of such players as Professor Longhair and Dr. John. Now he has a new recording. It's called 20. For the last few weeks, Harry Connick Jr. has been with us as Fresh Air's performer in residence. Today he has a couple of tunes from his hometown.
New Orleans, the Big Easy, the Crescent City, home of Louis Daniel Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton, among others. It's my hometown, and I'm proud to say that there's a lot of great songs that came out of Nawlins, as Dennis Quaid said in the Big Easy. And this particular tune is about a street not as famous as Bourbon Street, but almost, Basin Street.
It means just by what it really means. I'm glad to be, yes, siree, boo-doo-doo, in the land of reverie, and I can't lose my Basin Street blues.
Basin Street Blues. Boy, when I sing that tune, I think about all the great New Orleans musicians like Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong. But a couple of other musicians come to mind, like Professor Longhair and Dr. John and James Carroll Booker III. They're three pianists who have had an incredible influence on my piano playing and my singing as well. And right now, I'd like to do a tune that they all used to do with an influence of Dr. John, Professor Longhair, and James Booker, both pianistically and vocally. It's called Junko Partner.
Down the road, my Junko Partner, he was loaded, loaded as could be. Was knocked out, loaded, and he was singing, oh, was singing his song to me. If I had just $1 million. Well, let me tell you what I would do. I would buy land around Angola. Oh, it'd been a nice green garden till 1992. Yeah, go ahead. locked up. Oh, he was so loaded, was loaded, was loaded, loaded as could be. He was knocked out, knocked out, knocked out loaded. And he was singing, he was singing his song to me.
Harry Connick Jr.'s new album, 20, is on Columbia Records. This is Fresh Air. From his office overlooking downtown Medford, Oregon, Stuart Allen wants to change the way we see the world. Allen is a cartographer, or mapmaker. Part of the time, he designs conventional maps for oil companies or the government. But the rest of his time, he constructs oversized state wall maps, maps he hopes people will find beautiful and geographically inspiring. For most of us, our only contact with maps is when we need to get from here to there. I asked Stuart Allen what he thought of ordinary road maps.
You could say that they're not designed. They're constructed with a pretty simple end in mind, which is just that you're going to show people how to get to their great aunt's house, even if they've never been there before, on the other side of the state. They work for that. What they don't do is give you any sense of what that terrain is. That's where that range of mountains is. That's where that valley that I particularly like is, and that's the way it relates to, other cities or whatever.
I like what you're saying there about, so that's where it is, so that's where I am. Not too long ago, I had to make a trip, and I didn't have time to consult a map before flying to where I was going, and I had no idea where I was. I knew I was in the Midwest somewhere, but without a map, I really felt lost, just totally displaced.
In fact, I was flying over the Midwest last week, and I had a state road map in my lap, and I was very pleased with myself. As I never think of that, or if I do think of it, it's in the baggage. But this was carry on, so I was following the Illinois River as we were approaching O'Hare, and seeing towns that I knew on the ground, towns that I'd been in 25 years before and hadn't been in since. You know, felt very smug because I had the information there, and that's what a map ought to do, is give you the knowledge of where you are, give you the setting, it places you. It's, what is this that I'm going through? You know, what's the setting? Where am I? Not in the sense of where am I in between two points, but what is this whole setting? What's beyond the horizon? Where did this river come from that I'm crossing, and where does it go?
Well, you're interested in making your maps beautiful. How have you alter the design within the map to make it more pleasing? One of the things I can think of is that you use gorgeous colors. I mean, you have beautiful shades of blue-green that vary in intensity depending on the elevation. You have, really beautiful earth colors, different shades of browns in it.
One thing we do is use a lot of inks, which makes it a more expensive printing and a more expensive construction process. Really, the key is that we set out to make beautiful maps, and that's pretty much not done anymore. It was done, of course, in the old days, with the whales and the galleons and the goddesses and whatnot that were added to the maps. But as maps really became part of the military infrastructure, what became critical was that everything be precisely accurate. Well, everything should be precisely accurate, you know, and is on our maps. But at some point there, the idea that the map should be beautiful in itself, you know, a beautiful object, tended to fall away. And in fact, that was regarded as a distraction or a nuisance. It doesn't have to be, and it shouldn't be. I mean, ideally, a map is maybe the one place where truth and beauty are combined, or should be combined. I mean, there's no conflict, there's no fight between them.
Well, let's talk about the truth for a minute. You've talked a little bit about the beauty. How do you get the information that you need for your maps? Are you basically, for the main part of it, recopying maps that already exist?
Oh, yeah. Cartographers are great thieves. maps basically are stolen from existing maps.
And is that considered legitimate?
Oh, yeah, that's considered legitimate, particularly since you're normally stealing from your own government and from other and from other governments. Most of the information is public domain, and in fact, the state map series mostly consists of materials which are available from the U.S. Geological Survey. We handle them differently. We do different things with them, and that's what makes our maps look so different.
Now, you're also a traditional cartographer, right?
We do contract cartographic work for all kinds of people, particularly oil companies or scientific organizations or government agencies. Yeah, doing more conventional stuff. And that's interesting, and that's basically the work that pays the rent. But what we've wanted to do is kind of expand the boundaries of cartography as, I don't know, sort of consumer art, if that's a category that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If we looked at your state map of California and compared that to a state map of California that was drawn, say, 50 or maybe 100 years ago, would the geography of California be represented differently? I don't mean that, you know, the colors or the sensibility or anything, but just would the shape of the state have been any different? Has the knowledge that cartographers have now changed over the last century or half a century?
Yeah, the shape of the state wouldn't, it might be imperceptibly different, but you would have to measure it very precisely to tell. Certainly the surveys have become much more accurate. Now, between the satellite digital imagery and all the navigation aids, and the digital, the capacity to record information about absolutely everything digitally and retrieve it and stick it on a display some way, now we really know where everything is in the world, really in the world. Even places that were never mapped because they were under perpetual cloud cover are now mapped with radar. So in the last 10 years, we really know what the Amazon basin all looks like, which was never possible before. We know what everything looks like, and we're all of the major powers spying on each other and the rest of the world all the time, and mapping each other and the rest of the world all the time for military purposes. Most of the stuff never becomes available to the public. An awful lot of it goes into microchips on the nose of a bomber or into the nose of a missile, which is a disquieting thought. The warhead has a fantastic cartographic memory.
Did you fall in love with maps when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did. A lot of people love maps, and I did as a kid, although I never expected to go into it. I kind of backed into it, as so many of us back into our careers.
See, my early childhood memories of maps was having a teacher with this huge map that she would unroll from the blackboard. There'd be a pointer, and she'd say, she'd choose you and have you like come up and point to some obscure country that you'd never even heard of, and you knew you'd never be able to find it on the map. So maps were always kind of tied in with a certain amount of humiliation to me when I was young.
Yeah, the abuse of geography. That probably doesn't happen anymore, because I don't think it occurs to anyone that a kid would know where anything is anymore. You know, really, I think that's about right. They don't teach it. You've probably seen national surveys reported in the press. Kids don't know where Vietnam is. In fact, they're not sure that there is such a place, or maybe it's a rock group or something like that. There is that unfortunate storing up the lore. How many points on this enormous map can you properly identify, which is a shame. Really, if the map is beautiful enough, it sinks into your consciousness, you're going to absorb it, you know, to a great extent anyway.
So what map are you working on now?
Well, that's a series of maps of the world. There are going to be, I think, six of them. And then we just finished a map of Hawaii, including the seafloor, which looks very three-dimensional. That's been very satisfying. It just was printed 2 weeks ago, and we see people come up and feel it and kind of jump because they think it's a plastic raised relief map. You know? And then their fingers tell them it's flat, that their eye, their brain is telling them that it's three-dimensional. And there's a kind of a startled jump that people give when they see that. And when I see that, I think, that one worked. You know, that one is doing what it's supposed to do.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Cartographer Stuart Allen is a partner in the company Raven Maps in Medford, Oregon. He spoke to us from NPR station KSOR in nearby Ashland. This is Fresh Air.
This is Alex Chadwick. Coming up today on All Things Considered, a report from Moscow, where authorities are trying to deal with the outbreak of civil unrest in Azerbaijan. There have been several deaths in rioting there this week. In an unusual news conference tonight, broadcast live in Paris, French journalists questioned Soviet leader Gorbachev about his plans to deal with the crisis. And we'll have a report on how some analysts think minivans, those popular super station wagons, would be a lot safer if they had to comply with government standards for cars. Right now, they only have to comply with truck standards. And economists argue about whether the federal deficit matters, and a report on a new museum in a town in Georgia, a giant glass house that holds thousands of fluttering butterflies. That and more coming up this evening on All Things Considered.
Everywhere you turn these days, there are headlines and stories about AIDS, but critic at large Laurie Stone says many of them are inaccurate and misleading. She says better resources for AIDS information have sprung up in the arts community.
Most people know about AIDS from what they read in newspapers, hear on TV and radio, see in the scant number of movies that have depicted the disease. But in the book And the Band Played On, author Randy Schiltz shows that most journalists forego first-hand investigating and take figures about funding and research from government press releases. AIDS affects everyone's life in terms of how we practice and think about sex, in terms of healthcare costs, in terms of friends and relatives getting sick. Yet most of what we know is tailored by media that is biased against the majority of people with AIDS. Very few of us have direct experience of the disease. The activist organization ACT UP, which stands for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, has been working heroically to correct distortions about AIDS. The group got started in March of 87 after several artists designed and distributed powerful buttons with the logo Silence Equals Death. Last summer in Manhattan, to protest the increase of violence against gays and lesbians, ACT UP staged a sit-down on the site of an anti-gay knifing. In the fall, the group organized a demonstration against the Food and Drug Administration, which has been slow to release experimental drug treatments. Last year, Dr. Robert Gould published a reckless article in Cosmopolitan, which declared, despite contrary evidence collected by the Centers for Disease Control, that people couldn't get AIDS from penis to vagina intercourse. Women from ACT UP confronted Gould about his evidence, and the encounter was recorded in the video documentary, Doctors, Liars, and Women. Indeed, one of ACT UP's most eye-opening forms of activism has been with art media. The collective of graphic designers and painters responsible for ACT UP's startling work is Grand Fury. After New York City Health Commissioner Stephen Joseph lowered the estimate for new AIDS cases and thereby endangered much-needed funding, Grand Fury plastered city walls with posters showing a bloody handprint and the caption, "The cut in AIDS numbers is a lethal lie." Grand Fury placed posters in New York subways, alerting the public to the harrowing new statistic that one baby out of 61 born in New York City is HIV positive. The piece shows six photographs of people termed AIDS criminals, and when a light flashes on their images, quotations from them appear underneath. Below William F. Buckley, it says, "Everyone detected with AIDS should be tattooed in the upper forearm to protect common needle users, and on the buttocks to prevent the victimization of other homosexuals." Above the faces is a running electronic text. It reports, "The Pentagon spends in one day more than the government spent in the last 5 years for AIDS research and education." It reports, "The incidence of heterosexually transmitted AIDS is 17 times higher among blacks than whites and 15 times higher among Hispanics than whites, but only 6% of the U.S. AIDS education budget has been targeted for the minority community. With militance and style, ACT UP is seizing the means of representation to counter misrepresentations, which, along with silence, really do add up to death."
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Some of the videotapes she mentioned are available from the Gay Men's Health Crisis at area code 212-807-7517, and Testing the Limits Video Collective at area code 212-545-7120. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a conversation with veteran photographer Elliot Erwitt. His new book collects some of his best-known photographs, including pictures of Khrushchev, Kennedy, Nixon, and Rockefeller. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by alto saxophonist Bobby Watson. Like Witten and Bradford Marsalis, Watson is a graduate of drummer Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers. And television critic David Bianculli reviews What's New on Television. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Deborah Beagle, and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Our engineers are Orji Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.